Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
In our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Benjamin Wilfon, Professor-in-Chief in the Division of Bioethics at the University of Washington School of Medicine, about accepting brain death. This has been all over the news, and I think it's an important issue.
Yeah, and certainly ties into our conversations about ethics and trying to do the right things for our patients and our loved ones.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the conversation. But first, we've got some research that matters about depression and heart failure. Are they linked or maybe even causally related?
We're going to talk about depression. We're going to talk about watermelon, maybe lowers your blood pressure.
Yeah, we'll see.
Sounds delicious.
We're going to talk about circumcision and prostate cancer.
And we'll talk about some travel tips from our perspectives.
Sounds very good. Well, let's talk about this very first research that matters, Christy, about depression and heart failure. And I think we've known that once you have a diagnosis of heart failure, if you're depressed, your outcomes are much worse. So they're two bad diagnoses. When you get them together, they're even worse. But there's a question here that's an interesting one, which is, could depression actually cause heart failure?
And or if you are depressed, are you more likely to get heart failure? And in this case, this is the first really large prospective study, meaning they followed people forward to investigate if having depression increases your risk of developing heart failure. They started in 1995, followed people for 11 years, and at the beginning collected information on their physical activity, their weight, smoking habits, blood pressure, and some depression questions.
Of the nearly 63,000 people from Norway in the study, 1,500 of them developed heart failure. And looking at just those who had symptoms of depression, those who had just mild symptoms still had a 5% increased risk of heart failure. But those with moderate to severe symptoms had a 40% increased risk for developing heart failure. And this is despite their smoking or obesity status. So it wasn't just that.
And so it's unclear what the mechanism could be. Is it that depression triggers stress hormones, or is there some other thing that puts people at risk? Maybe if you're more depressed, there are other behaviors that are different, or something else going chemically in the body. It's hard to know what the cause exactly could be. What do you think?
Well, I think it drives home the point that if you don't have heart failure, but you're pretty depressed, and you develop symptoms of shortness of breath, you should be seeing your doctor for two reasons and having it worked up. And let's not just assume that these are completely unrelated. They could be true related. We'll see. More work to be done.
Do you like watermelon, Adam?
I do like watermelon. And
I like
I'm
it
really
when I cover it in salt.
That was, I think, last week's show, Christy. But we're in this week's show, and the question really is can there be some blood pressure-lowering effect of watermelon, or at least the ingredients of watermelon, which I was like, what are the ingredients of watermelon besides water and a little bit of melon?
Exactly. Well, this was a 12-week study where they focused on 13 middle-aged obese men and women who also suffer from high blood pressure. And they put them in simulated cold weather conditions, and then they divided half of them to get 4 grams of the amino acid L-citrulline and 2 grams of L-arginine per day. Both of them are from the watermelon extract.
That doesn't sound like watermelon to me, though.
I know, doesn't to me either. The other group
sounds
got
like a pill, and I don't like that.
I know. The other group got a placebo for 6 weeks, and then they switched them to see what happened with their blood pressure and pressure on the aorta.
And they did say that those who had these extracts from the watermelon seemed to have improvements in their blood pressure, both at rest and when they were exposed to this cold area, suggesting that maybe there's an improvement with watermelon. Christy, I think this has a long way to go before I'm going to recommend a watermelon for lowering blood pressure. But I could recommend it for a lot of other reasons, to make you happy.
That's right. It is nice. It's full of water and makes you feel good in the summertime.
I'm not sure there's a downside necessarily here compared to a positive upside. So
Yeah. And, you know, we need to know not just about blood pressure itself, but longer term outcomes and have this studied in a larger number of people. But it's going to make me enjoy my watermelon just a little bit more this summer.
Along with your strawberries and blueberries and other types of berries. Oh, my.
That's right. Oh, my.
And watermelon. It doesn't really fit so easily.
It doesn't fit with our little jingle. Okay. Let's talk about circumcision.
Let's talk about this last research that matters, which is circumcision and prostate cancer. I don't think we've talked about this on the show before.
Okay, so circumcision is controversial in America. Some people do it, some people don't. There is a link, we know, with a decrease in HIV for people who live in Africa. But this was a study looking at this link or potential link between circumcision and prostate cancer.
You know, I think this is an interesting link because we don't have a whole lot to offer really for reducing prostate cancer now, other than when we can get it treated and hard to diagnose it early. But in this particular study, they interviewed a little over 2,100 men who were living on the island of Montreal, and half of them had been diagnosed with prostate cancer between 2005 and 2009. And the other were this control group, and they wanted to find out what things may relate to this diagnosis of prostate cancer, including whether or not they were circumcised.
They found across the board, the participants who were circumcised were 11% less likely to later in life develop prostate cancer compared to those who weren't. And then when they broke it down into different groups, that difference was more significant.
And they did find that the older men who were circumcised had significantly less risk of later developing prostate cancer, but it's some question as to why they were really circumcised at those later ages. And they did find that the consistent with some other studies, that the rate of prostate cancer was higher among those who were African-American in the study, and that their rate of circumcision was lower. Now, this study certainly doesn't prove causality, yeah, but I think it's an interesting question and an important question to address and to get more research on.
Absolutely. This isn't enough for us to go out and circumcise all the people, especially from what we know about prostate cancer, which, you know, a lot of people, the mantra is more people die with prostate cancer than from prostate cancer. So to try to sort out which ones are significant and not and how that ties in with circumcision needs more study for sure. Let's talk about top summer travel tips, Adam.
Yeah, they were about to enter the summer season, Christy, and we thought this might be fun here. And we kind of joked around beforehand about which can be a top tips. And I came up with one, which is to wear rain, buy and pack a little rain jacket. I can tell you how many times I've been traveling and caught with, like, no rain jacket there. So an inexpensive $5 rain jacket, though it's not a health tip, but I'm throwing it out there.
Okay, fine.
What's your first health tip?
Well, I would say plan to drink water and to look for sources of clean water. And really be careful about what you eat and thinking about where it's been cooked and if that is in contact with unclean water to prevent you from getting diarrheal illnesses.
No surprise, Christy. My next one's going to be sunscreen, sunscreen, and sunscreen. Pack your sunscreen.
Hat, long sleeves.
SPF, 30 or above, 45 is good. Get UVA, UVB, UVC protection. And, you know, getting a burn is not fun, in addition to your melanoma risk while you're traveling in particular.
If you're going somewhere that is relevant to this, get immunizations that are appropriate or take malaria medication for prophylaxis.
Make sure you have travel insurance in case you need to be evacuated. Look into us. It's not that expensive, and it may be life-saving. In addition to which, have your name of your doctor written down and make sure your doctor knows you're traveling so you can contact them back home and write your medications down in case you're hospitalized and someone needs to know about it.
Yep. Know those emergency contacts. Know where you would go for help. If you're in a new place, try to sort out, well, if something happened, where are you going to go?
One last question, Christy. Would you pack, when you went to Africa, did you get some antibiotics in case you had a really bad traveler's diarrhea?
Oh, yes. I had some for me and some for the children, just in case. We didn't know what we were going to be exposed to. So we had that with us. Thankfully, we didn't need it. But
well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We've had a chance to talk about circumcision and prostate cancer.
To talk about eating watermelon might lower blood pressure.
about depression and heart failure.
And a little bit about some summer travel tips. We'll post something on our blog about those summer travel tips. That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but we'll come back talking with Dr. Benjamin Wilfund, professor and chief in the Division of Bioethics at the University of Washington School of Medicine, as well as the director of the Truman Katz Center for Pediatric Bioethics, about accepting brain death. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Benjamin Wilfund, professor in chief in the Division of Bioethics at the University of Washington School of Medicine, about accepting brain death.
Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Wilfund.
My pleasure.
You know, you wrote this perspective piece very recently in the New England Journal of Medicine about accepting brain death. And you obviously have a lot of experience as a director of Center of Pediatric Bioethics. What was it that led you to write this piece and to be so passionate about this topic?
Well, we wrote the piece because there had been a number of cases that were publicized in the media over the last 6 months. And myself and my co-authors have some convergence of views and some difference of views, and part of us writing the paper was trying to help us get better clarity about what were the critical things that we thought that people needed to understand about brain death and how to apply it in end-of-life decision-making.
You know, there are these two cases you mentioned were so much a part of our entire public dialogue, the case in Oakland, California about Jai McMath's death, in Fort Worth, Texas about Marlies Muno's body and pregnancy. Let's start off, though, with just saying, when we talk about brain death, what are we talking about? Is that a common—do everyone know when we say brain death that what it is?
You know, I don't think necessarily people do, and in fact, certainly even when we talk with clinicians, there's lots of confusion about it. The intention of brain death is to describe the circumstance in which there has been an irreversible loss of cognitive functioning, you know, the cortex of the brain, as well as of the brain stem, which is the part of the brain that does a lot of sort of automatic functioning in terms of heart rate and respiratory rate and things like that.
And so this is the general term that people understand that encompasses this concept of the brain is not working again and will not get function?
Right.
And how does that differ from when we say you're dead?
Well, that's a great question. And I think there is, in other words, normally up until the advent of things like mechanical ventilation, the idea of death was cardiopulmonary death, the idea of the heart ceasing to function. But historically, even the determination of death has been complicated and ambiguous. And there are lots of stories of people who were thought to be dead who weren't dead because they seemed dead. So the idea of determining death and the role of a doctor in determining death historically has been important because of a sense that they are better than other people in distinguishing death from things that are close to death.
I know we want to get into some of the stories and the ethical dilemmas and disagreements with families and all of it. But the issue of technology and the advances in technology and the beauty of it must have a major role in how this has evolved over time as well. Could you frame that for us?
Sure. Well, again, we talked briefly about the idea of mechanical ventilation. And so the idea that prior to mechanical ventilation, when a person could no longer breathe on their own, they would become dead, to use that word more dramatically. But with mechanical ventilation, it was possible to keep a person breathing. And where this became a dilemma was as it related to the idea of organ transplantation, because one of the ideas for organ transplantation was how could we justify taking organs out of a living person, or a sense that that would be a line that we would want not to cross. And part of the way this was resolved in the late 60s was to suggest, well, actually, somebody whose heart is still beating, who's still breathing on a ventilator, but if their brain has ceased functioning, that may be enough to call them dead. And that's where the idea of brain death came about. It really was related to the possibility, the potential for organ transplantation. And the reason why I bring that up is because you don't have to be brain dead for also, well, actually, I should back up. The other issue with the ventilator is that even if you're not brain dead, there may be many people who would not wish to continue to be living on a ventilator in other conditions in which they would expect not to have any recovery. And so we really developed from the 70s on concepts that you can withdraw a ventilator, even for somebody who still is alive, to end their life because from the perspective of that patient or their family, it doesn't make sense to continue that way.
You know, you mentioned people who we thought could perhaps be dead and came back to life, people where we thought may have been when coma. And I guess that is really lays at the heart of some of the fear here. Can you just real briefly run through that there's not just one criteria for brain death. It's not just like, oh, an MRI or something. There are lots of criteria that you have to fulfill. Can you review some of those so that maybe our listeners and maybe our doctors can really know when we're talking about brain death as certified by whom, it's pretty certain.
It is pretty certain, but the criteria keep changing. So the first of all, the part of the criteria for brain death is to make sure that there is a lack of other things that may be contributing to the problem that are reversible, such as the presence of medications that can actually suppress brain function. Make sure that the person is not hypothermic, which would also suppress brain function. So, you know, there's a joke about you can't be cold and dead, you have to be warm and dead to avoid that thing. The main focus of the evaluation for brain death is looking at the brain stem and looking at the various functions of the brain stem in terms of cortical nerve function and respiratory function. And most of the tests relate to those. And the most explicit test is what's called the apnea test, which is a test where the person is removed from the ventilator and off the ventilator watching their CO2 rise, suggesting that they are having a trigger to breathe on their own but are not responding to that, and then suggesting, therefore, that brain stem is functioning.
This is really complex. So all of the stuff that's going on in an ICU-level care when someone is on a ventilator and decisions that families need to make, and a lot of times it centers around when to turn off that ventilator. It's hard to explain all of those years and study that happened in medical school from the doctor's perspective in terms that families can understand. I'm thinking of a family a long time ago of a baby who was clearly not going to live, you know, fixed pupils and was long gone. And I asked the neonatologist, you know, at what point are you going to tell the family, like, this is done? And he says, well, we can keep this going for days. And I remember saying, well, you know, please don't, be careful not to ask the family to make a decision about turning, or not to frame it in their decision to continue on or to stop, when in this case there was there was no hope. Is that a typical kind of scenario, or how do doctors frame these things and explain it to patients?
You know, Chris, that's an excellent question, and I think what you're pointing out is that even before brain death, there may be circumstances where a family may decide to withdraw the ventilator, and I think one of the challenges is how to talk with families about that in a way that helps them make a decision that's appropriate for their values, mm-hmm. but also doesn't place the burden on them to feel like they're making the decision by themselves. And so that's a very difficult nuance. Also, people do have different views. So you can imagine circumstances where one family would want to continue and another family would not. And so that's when it does become very important mm-hmm. to find out what the family's thinking. But at the same time, to frame it in such a way where the family doesn't have to feel like they killed their child or they caused their child to die or they gave up on their child.
Exactly.
Well, you know, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. Benjamin Wilfon, professor in chief in the Division of Bioethics at the University of Washington School of Medicine, about accepting brain death. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Benjamin Wilfon, professor and chief in the Division of Bioethics at the University of Washington School of Medicine, about accepting brain death. And Dr. Wilfon, I know this the stories in the newspaper, the two cases, were seem to be opposite poles, that one person, Jahai's family, didn't want to be taken off life support after she was declared brain dead. On the other hand, Marlisa's family wanted her removed to ensure her wishes were met after she was pronounced but was kept on life support by the state. What is it about these stories that we really should take home and learn, and why were they so controversial in the court of public opinion?
Well, I think they're controversial because they point out that not only is the public, but even clinicians have different views about brain death and how it does or doesn't matter. I think the idea and reason why we wrote the paper with the title Accepting Brain Death is because we do think that brain death is a very important concept, both medically and socially, in which it's appropriate to say a person is dead, in that there is an irreversible loss of brain function that will never recover. And that when institutions have to make decisions about patient care, brain death is a very important time to make that determination and that distinction. But part of why it's controversial is because this person doesn't look dead. Their heart is still beating. With a respirator, they're still breathing. And so many families who otherwise are having a difficult time with the idea of a loss of a loved one can find the idea of brain death to be very counterfactual.
But yet, if a person is determined to be brain dead, if you turn off the machines, they won't live.
That's correct.
And so I think that that clarity for people may be part of it. And do you think the controversy that families feel is hope? If the families who really value doing everything possible for their loved one, is it the hope that their brain would turn around? Or what are the factors that make people not able to accept that?
You know, I think there can be different factors in different circumstances. And sometimes it may be the hope that things will get better. It may be that they actually appreciate that things won't get better, but they still value that person as they are, even though they're brain dead. So you can't really make a generalization why a family is doing that. And in fact, there are some circumstances. In fact, we have lots of evidence about how long bodies have been able to be maintained after brain death has been declared, because in spite of these two cases, not in spite of these two cases, but that these are not the first two cases. This has happened before, often with less controversy, and bodies have been maintained for weeks and months in some circumstances for a variety of reasons, including family requests.
So let's talk about that for a second. I'll put it in a personal thing. I know my wife and I have the conversations if we were each in an irreversible coma, and she says, you know, pull the plug. And I say, wait a week, wait 2 weeks. And part of this belief of some uncertainty and maybe people are wanting to too quickly do things, but in part you raise this question of, can a patient have any voice in this? Can a patient's family member have any voice in this? You suggest they can. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, a couple different things. Certainly, even with brain death as a determination of death, depending upon the circumstances, the hospitals can have some flexibility with what they decide to do and how they decide to do that. The biggest issue why people may not believe in brain death is because of their own lack of trust in either the healthcare system as a whole or the particular group of providers. And sometimes, paradoxically, accommodating families' views, even when they're disparate, may be one of the ways of regaining that trust. And I'll give you a very quick example of a circumstance I was involved with about almost 10 years ago, in which a patient was declared brain dead. The family was not yet ready to accept it. They asked for an herbal treatment that needed to be obtained from another country, from a long way away, that would take 5 days. And the clinical team agreed to wait 5 days for this herbal treatment to be available, to be provided. And in fact, by doing that, accommodating the family's wishes, having their herbal treatment available, being used, having the family see that did not work, allowed them to come around and accept what was going on, rather than trying to say to them, your child is dead, we must stop the ventilator today.
And that seems, you know the data better than I do, but it seems, at least in our area, that is a much more common scenario where the clinical teams are really trying to give families time and understanding and make every effort for the family to feel comfortable with that, sort of the finality of turning off those machines, and that's far more common than going to some legal place to make a decision about having to end it when the family is against it.
Definitely. And the other point I want to bring up is that brain death becomes more challenging is because of the absolute finality of that. But in fact, there are many circumstances where people are in an irreversible coma, as best we can tell, but are not brain dead. And again, families have different thresholds, just Adam, just as you're describing, when a person and the family is ready to stop the ventilator at that point. Some are willing to do it right away, some want to wait months, some want to wait a day.
You know, you talked about the patient sometimes needing time to accept it. I think I recall a patient of mine that was brain dead and how difficult it was for me when I first heard this to come to accept it. It seems like, though, that conflict between patients or maybe even doctors' time to accept it may run into play against insurance companies' willingness, because if someone is brain dead, should they continue to have to pay for it? Do you think there's going to need to be legislation to define how long it is before it's turned off, or at least how long it could be, so that patients and families are protected?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think the two cases that we heard about in the media were a bit of an anomaly. And so I think, in general, this has worked out really pretty well with regards to the issue of giving families time to accommodate this. And when we think about all the things that we spend healthcare resources on, and particularly at the end of life, healthcare resources are spent not only for the patient but for the family. For those few families who need a few more days, that's probably a very good use of our healthcare mm-hmm. resources in the grand scheme of things and many other things that are provided for. And the number of families who request this are probably pretty small. So I think this is actually a place where I would very much want to see some space for families to have some latitude. At the same time, really think that collectively as a country, we do have to accept that when you are brain dead, you are dead, and we need to act that way.
We really want to thank Dr. Benjamin Wilfon, professor in chief in the Division of Bioethics at the University of Washington School of Medicine, for being with us today to have a conversation about accepting brain death. Certainly having the conversation is a starting place, and we thank you for having the conversation in the New England Journal of Medicine with your co-authors and with us today.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, we want you to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We've got some good stories and questions today, and we will jump right in and have our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, read us our very first House Call question. Erica?
Within the last 2 days, I've noticed that my bowel movements are really green in color. I know one is supposed to seek immediate help if their stool is black or red, so I'm not in full-fledged panic mode yet. I have not changed my diet, and while I'm being honest, I must say that I don't eat many fruits or vegetables, so I highly doubt this is the reason for the color change. What are your thoughts?
Well, Christy, my first thought is what I say to my patients sometimes, and to my children, who sometimes share this information with very graphic color descriptions of their bowels. I say, thank you for sharing.
Thank you. I know. My patients take pictures
about, right?
Sometimes. They take pictures and show me, you know.
Like, well, that way you could certainly tell the color. Absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I think there can be a lot of variations in color. And I don't know that we as doctors really understand all the different things that might change the color. But you're right, listener, in that what you said about if you had black tarry stools or if you had a lot of blood in your stool, that would certainly be something to seek medical attention for. But a change in the color of your stool, usually I attribute it to something different that you ate. Although you say you haven't changed your diet much, sometimes we don't notice a change, or there could be an additive to something. There can be changes in your gallbladder or other things in the body that can turn your stool white. But to have it green every now and then, maybe somewhere you did slip in a vegetable.
Yeah, Christy, the thing that comes to mind, I mean, certainly sometimes I know breastfeeding and other elements in the baby, you see that kind of frequently. That's certain medications. If you're taking any new medicine, mm-hmm. any new supplement, any new herbal medication, I think, you know, that could cause that. This isn't something that, you know, I think I've seen a lot, but you know what, we'll kind of look up on the website, because we both think that, you know, spinach and some of the green leafy vegetables in particular certainly could cause this green stool.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your question. Let's take our very next House Call question.
I've always had extremely heavy menstrual periods. I typically use one tampon every hour or so while I'm awake. Even the super absorbing ones don't help that much. Those will last me maybe an hour if I'm lucky. I've been checked and double-checked by my gynecologist, and he said everything appears to be normal. My family does not believe in oral contraceptives, so I'm not comfortable with taking birth control to decrease my flow. I would appreciate your thoughts.
Well, first off, this is a hard issue here, and we wouldn't say lightly. You know, I think if you're going through, you know, 12 to 20 tampons a day, that's a lot during your period. And not only is that uncomfortable and maybe embarrassing, it's also something that you're going to become anemic.
And hopefully your doctor did check your thyroid and check to see if maybe fibroids were involved. Or the thing I hadn't gleaned is how old you are and what your hopes are in terms of having children and what your plans are around that. If you're done having children, it makes the approach to this a little bit more simple in that there are, if hormone treatments are not something that you want to pursue, there are surgical treatments that can help.
Yeah, and you know, reassuring that one's okay because one doesn't detect anything on physical examination doesn't necessarily mean that there couldn't be still some other things going on. So whether or not you've had an ultrasound or other ways to look for what's called fibroids, which certainly can cause bleeding and might need some surgery mm-hmm. or some other medicines. And then I would also explore what it means to take hormonal treatment, because one can talk about natural hormones, one can talk about man-made hormones, and they're not much different. A lot of times people say it's okay to take the natural hormones, but not the man-made. They're about the same thing.
And there's also, for people who have this falls into dysfunctional uterine bleeding, for people who have heavy periods, sometimes having an IUD called a Mirena IUD can be helpful to reduce the amount of bleeding and make you even have very light periods. Some people don't have periods at all with that particular thing. But depending on your values, if hormones are not an option, it does have a small amount of progesterone in it.
A real simple treatment is just to take an oral non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent. If you can take that and your stomach's okay and don't have any other contraindication, that can cut down on bleeding and menstrual blood flow loss by 20 to 50% in most women. So that's a very simple tool if you haven't tried it.
Okay, thank you for your call, and we hope that you continue to work with your doctor to sort this out and that that gets better for you. Let's take our last house call question. Or we have two more. Let's take two more.
I'm a 25-year-old male who recently experienced hemorrhoids. I could have never imagined the pain involved. After tearing up from the pain once, okay, twice, I swore I would do anything in my power to keep myself from going through this again. What can I do to prevent hemorrhoids from occurring and or make them go away sooner if they return?
Well, you're not alone out there. I can't tell you the number of people who actually come in to see me, and I'm sure you, Christy, and my colleagues, who are kind of similar, and they always are sheepishly embarrassed, as if they think they're alone. You're not.
You're not alone, and very common for women after having children as well. The best thing to do is to try to prevent constipation. So drinking lots of water, eating a lot of fiber through fruits and vegetables. Some people even take fiber supplements. There are over-the-counter meds that can be calming. And then when they get really fired up, sometimes a prescription medicine that has a little bit of steroid in it that you can put inside your bottom right up against the hormone, right up against the hemorrhoid, can help to decrease that inflammation and pain.
Yeah, a lot of these products that help move stool through, that fiber, Citrusil or Metamucil, brand names here, it gives about 15 grams of fiber per day, and you only need about 30 grams. So that's half the battle right there. And then magnesium-based laxatives or, milk of magnesia, magnesium citrate, things you can buy over the counter can move it. A lot of ways to move it. You need a lot of different tools in your armamentarium. I didn't say that word right. How do you say that word, Christy?
In your armory?
Yeah, you're getting there.
I don't know what you mean here. Arsenal. That's
arsenal.
The word.
That'll work. Thank you so much for that question. Erica, what's our next and last house call?
My teenage daughter and I listen to your show every Saturday morning. She has always been interested in science, and she's beginning to think of going to medical school after college. I will say I'm probably getting ahead of myself since she's only 16, but she loves your show, and she can talk forever after the show ends about the topic. When did the two of you realize that you wanted to be physicians, specifically family doctors? I know my daughter will look forward to hearing your answers.
That's so sweet.
That is. I know it can't be my daughter that's asked this question. I know she's really interested in medicine, but she doesn't listen every single week. But you know what? We appreciate that sentiment.
We do. And I'll share briefly. I think as a teenager, I thought of it. I had an intense experience with my father's death and was impressed with how the medical community pulled together for him. Thought I wanted to be a Christian minister or a missionary. And then through service and through interest in getting to know people, I was pulled into family medicine. I think I was attracted to that specifically because of the focus on meaningful long-term relationships with patients and to be able to be around people who are also committed to service, and that's what drew me in.
You were a teenager, Christy?
I was.
I can't believe You've always been a really nice adult. You were probably a really nice teenager. I will say for myself that I didn't know I wanted to be in family medicine until I did my last rotation as a junior medical student. It tells you how late and the formative experiences are. And as I was doing the other rotations, I kind of liked everything, but I didn't like the surgeons because I liked the non-surgical care more than the surgery care. I didn't like the hospital care because it just reminded me of coffins with doors and windows. This belief of going out there and finding the family doctors who seemed to be having fun. A lot of the other doctors maybe were less miserable, and the family doctor seemed to be really happy. And so for myself, in my own experience, you can't discount that, but that's what it was. I said, I really want to be happy. Now, I'm sure that's a very limited experience, and hopefully every physician is really happy with what they do.
Well, I am grateful for both of us that we have been able to follow paths where we can love what we do and be able to invest in people in a meaningful way.
Well, we encourage your daughter. I don't think 16 is too young. I think my wife knew at 16 she'd been working in doctor's offices, and she was going to be a doctor. Matter of fact, her parents told her, you're going to be a doctor. So good luck with that. If Christy and I can do anything to help you or any of our listeners in their career choices, feel free to give us a call. And you can send any questions to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, get our health app on your phone, and listen to us. Send us your questions.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Benjamin Walfund. We'll hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'm going to look forward to talking to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.